Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Good morning, everyone. It's so exciting to be here with my two co-hosts, Dave and Pete. And Dave, we got to catch up in person on the weekend. How good was that?
That was awesome to finally see you and Ian after so long and head out for dinner in Yarraville and have a couple quiet vinos.
They weren't that quiet. We both had sore heads on Sunday.
We sure did. We sure.
You had to tackle kids and play sport, I felt
yeah.
for you.
Made it through, though.
Pete, your turn next time. As soon as you're over here, we'll get on it and have a good time.
You're more than welcome to come over because yesterday, which was the 23rd of November, we opened our borders to everybody. If you're vaccinated, there's no quarantining. If you're unvaccinated, you have to quarantine for 14 days. So apparently there's been scheduled an extra 100 flights in and out of Adelaide because of all the people that want to come back because they've been stuck in the eastern states. So we're getting back to normal, which is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it does feel good. It really does.
So, Kate, what's your market update?
My market update relates to the number of weekends we've got left until we take our summer break and finish this crazy property season for Christmas. And there's only a few weekends left. And you can see in the auction-centric cities, we've got auctions booked all the way up to the 18th. And there are also quite a number of midweek auctions. And what we tend to find as we get closer to Christmas is buyers drop off. They're getting distracted with getting ready for Christmas. Some of them are fatigued, but you still have your really committed buyers all the way to the end. And interestingly, we always see every year, as we get closer to Christmas Day, competition gets a little bit more difficult because people are really fighting it out in that last battle, knowing if I don't buy something now, there's no more stock for me to choose from and it will be a long wait until February. So what I would urge buyers to consider while they're out there shopping now is bear that in mind and don't leave it to the very end. If there's a property or a couple of properties that are meeting the grade and are certainly ticking all the right boxes, get yourself ready and go for them. Don't assume that you'll get a bargain in that final few days before Christmas.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Kate. Dave, what's your market update?
My market update is APRA have made some announcements in the last week, which is going to make interest-only loans more expensive over the coming year or two. So basically, banks need to hold more cash in reserves for every dollar they lend out for interest-only loans, which effectively makes them more expensive to them. So that transition will be occurring over the next... It comes into force in January 2023. For example, you're looking to take out an interest-only loan. You might consider fixing because it's likely the margin between principal and interest and interest-only loans are going to increase further again as they have done recently. And this is in relation to the so-called Basel III Global Standards, which is set down by the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision about making banks across the world unquestionably strong. And yeah, APRA have clarified their requirements, which are a bit more stringent than expected during the week. And I suspect they've made that call a bit earlier than people expected because they see it as another little tool towards taking the heat out of the property market.
Excellent. Thank you for that overview, Dave. And I've got my little market update is about population movement. So the REA Group, which is realestate.com.au, came out with a report telling us where people have moved to. And Queensland has been the greatest has had the greatest benefit from people moving there. So they've had just over 30,000 people move in the 12 months to March 2021. And a lot of them came from Sydney and Melbourne because Sydney had a net loss of 31,000 Melbourne had a net loss of 32,000, but it's not like they all went, everyone, well, all those people went from Sydney to Queensland, because regional New South Wales and regional Victoria benefited. So even though, say, Sydney lost 31,000 people, their regional area increased by 13,000. Melbourne lost 32,000 people, but their regional area increased by almost 14,000. So I was thinking, how do these relatively small numbers make such a significant impact on property prices and rents? Because, you know, Sydney and Melbourne, they got millions of people. What difference does it make if you've got an extra 10 or 20,000? But it occurred to me, it's what stock is available at the time. So you imagine, let's say you go to, what I like to do to try and explain things and is bring them down to a scalable size. So let's say you go into a town and there's 100 households in 100 houses and one new household moves in, right? That's not a large amount. But it's not like all 100 households are available for sale or available for rent. There is only a small percentage of those available for sale or rent. So what I think it's showing is, one, there's been a lack of supply, which has helped exacerbate the fact that property prices have gone up when you've had extra people move in to an area. Not only have extra people moved in, but there's less property for them to buy or to rent. So I found that quite interesting. I'm sure the movement to Queensland will continue. It's just phenomenal, the amount of people that are looking to move to southeast Queensland. But as we've said on a previous show, just because lots of people are moving there doesn't mean the property prices will go up, because it's about supply and demand. If 100,000 households move up there and they build an extra 100,000 new houses for them, well, in theory, price is not going anywhere. So, yeah, I just found that quite interesting.
It's a really great overview, Pete, and a good pathway to go down, isn't it? And your point on, you know, like 15,000 or give or take that have moved into the regional areas. But yeah, break down, okay, which are the major towns or cities that people have been moving into? Then how many properties have they had on the market at any given time over that period or across that period? That's what the 15,000 people are competing for.
Yeah, so you said, you know, some of the top regions, Queensland's Gold Coast and Sunshine Coast, top two. But Kate, Geelong, number three in Australia. Lots of people moving to Geelong.
Yeah, well, you've got all of the factors that you talked about, Pete, but you've also got Melbourne equity and Melbourne incomes. And when you're taking a higher income family into an area, you're already in a position to fight it out for the property. And if you've got a couple of those people, the Geelong agents will definitely attest to this. They're watching Melburnians bidding the prices up. And I think a lot of people are pretty disheartened about the whole thing, but it does happen. And let's look at Hobart. It's a small city. It's really more like a regional city. And we've had a lot of people flocking to Hobart for various reasons. It was another popular place to go when you'd had enough of COVID lockdowns. And it too has demonstrated some crazy growth. And it's because taking a certain number of people out of a big capital city and into a smaller city is a much larger percentage change for the smaller city. So to your point, not enough stock to meet the demand, and you've got higher incomes pushing prices up, it's not a surprise.
No, and we're seeing the same thing across borders. So Melbourne and Sydney money coming to Adelaide. So, you know, they're outbidding a lot of the locals because they've got a lot more equity. And especially now, 23rd of November, the South Australian borders open. So that's certainly been exacerbated once again.
I've also been thinking about these numbers and how long-lasting they are, not just for the people who've moved and then decide, look, I don't really enjoy where I'm living and then move back. But also, you know, I've got friends and neighbours who have relocated, you know, and in effect they've bought a holiday house, you know, down on the Ballerine Peninsula or Mornington Peninsula. You know, are they being counted in those numbers? They quite possibly are, but they haven't really moved. So
I think the way that they decipher population movement is your address on your Medicare card. I think that's how they do it. I'm not sure if the REA does that, but I'm pretty sure that's what the ABS and other government departments do. Well, a very comprehensive market update for our listeners there. I hope you've got a few takeaways.
I love your style, Pete. You said, I'm just going to have a little market update myself.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Well, today we've got a really exciting topic. We're continuing on actually from A to E, and it's interesting because we take turns in hosting. And the last time I hosted, I did A to E. And today we've got F to K. So it is an exciting one. And Preet, you've provided some great notes yet again. So I'm going to launch into today's podcast and start with F is for first home buyers. And we deal with first home buyers all the time. And there are lots of different quirks to first home buyers, but there's a lot of vulnerability. And for a good reason, you'll often find advisors who really love working with first home buyers because it can be such a rewarding brief as well. And I know that you two both feel the same. So let's kick off with first home buyers. And Dave, I'm going to put the microphone over to you and let you discuss what do first home buyers need to do to be organized.
They need to do a lot, Kate. It's probably the hardest stage of buying to be organised because you haven't done any of it before and you're still often early in your life. You know, you don't know where you're going to live long term. You haven't found your life partner. If you do end up having one, if you plan to have kids, you haven't had kids. So there's a lot more things to wade through.
Mm.
You know, I think whether you're buying a home or an investment property can be a much bigger conundrum because both pathways can be very feasible often for first time buyers. As we know, the bank of mum and dad is playing a bigger role than it ever has done before. You know, the interest we can earn on savings isn't the greatest with rates being low, which can potentially make it a bit harder to save for a deposit.
Yeah.
You know, understanding all the ins and outs of mortgages and mortgage strategy is also new. So, yeah, there's a lot to consider. It's what makes it so fulfilling for an advisor when you work with first-time buyers. And it also makes it so hard for first-time buyers because it's all new.
Yes.
And, yeah, and they don't know what to expect from the people they work with either. So it's hard for them to gauge whether they're getting great advice and service or rubbish advice and service.
Very, very true. And I know from thinking back to my early years as a first-time buyer, I was very reluctant to just blindly trust referred people. In fact, you're programmed at that age to trust your parents and to trust people around you. Mm. And yep. We'll talk about that in a couple of points down my page because having your parents by your side can be wonderful, but it can also trip up a good strategy if they're giving you advice that they're not really qualified to give you and they don't really understand. And that's always a real challenge. But let's talk about the financing component first up, because that is what separates a first home buyer from an upgrader, downsizer, investor. They've already got a significant disadvantage, and I'll get you to talk about that. And it's in relation to their borrowing capacity, because unlike any other purchaser, they've generally got a requirement to come up with a deposit and they have to save that in most cases. So can you discuss with our audience why it's a lot harder for a first-time buyer to calculate their borrowing capacity?
Well, it's a lot harder because they generally, yeah, they won't have equity. They're a first-time buyer and therefore, although their income may be very strong, what actually might hold them back is their savings and their ability to cover. You know, people will say the 20% plus cost, but, you know, it's not actually 20% that the media often talk about. As most people will know, you know, you can usually borrow, if you're purchasing a home, 95% of the value of the property, but you need 5%. Then you need mortgage insurance, which might be another 3 or 4% of the purchase price, so that's 9%. Then stamp duties, that's another 5 or 6% of the purchase price, so we're up to 15%. And then you need to have money in the bank after you settle on the property so you can furnish it and, you know, pay for other things. So the reality is you do need, even at the bottom level or where you're borrowing the most, you still do need actually around 20% as a minimum. And that particularly if you're in a major capital city, particularly in Melbourne or Sydney, and, you know, that can be a lot to save up in today's, you know, with the proportion of income to property values as it stands.
Well, I'm going to come back to you because there are some ways that parents can help across the board in lots of different ways, but specifically when it comes to deposit sizes. We'll come back to you, Dave.
We better let Pete chat because this is his episode.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Pete, what do first-time buyers often overlook? And you've lived through this with students, with people in your community and with your children. What do firsties overlook?
So one is the finance, because you do need, it's not just the deposit, but there are other costs. However, Anne-Marie is going to post in our notes a link which includes all the first home owners' assistance around the country. And a good one to have a look at, doesn't matter which state you're in, is the federal government's first home loan deposit scheme. So if you only have a 5% deposit, the government will guarantee the rest of it, so the remaining 15%. They're not going to give you an extra 15%, but what they say is you don't have to pay lender's mortgage insurance. So Dave said before you might need up to 20% if you qualify for this scheme, and most people would if for a first time, but if you've already had an investment property, then you won't qualify for this. But if you're buying your first property and it happens to be your home, you can save yourself the heartache of saving extra for the lender's mortgage insurance, because the government will guarantee that. And for every state and territory, I won't go through it now, but it outlines what you are able to access. Another thing that first-time buyers need to consider is where they want to live. Now, is this going to be your forever home? Is your first home going to be your forever home? If it is, then it's critical. You know, you've got to work out, all right, well, we might want to be near the kids' primary school for now, but they're only going to go to primary school for 6 years. So what's going to happen for the other 10, 20, 30 years that you're going to be there? So work out where you want to live. What do you want to live in? Is a unit or a flat going to be okay? All right, whilst you're either on your own or you don't have any dependents, that might be fine. But if you plan to stay in the house for a long time, you need to consider either you're going to be shifting or you need the opportunity to be able to extend. And I would also have two columns, the must-haves and the nice-to-haves. So far as the location is concerned, what you want to live in, any other criteria, which is must-have, so no negotiation, and which is nice-to-have. So, for example, you know, it might be nice to be close to the beach, but that's not critical. That's not going to be the deal-breaker for you. But maybe being close to your families is a must-have, because you plan to have kids, you want the babysitters nearby. So I think to have those two columns of what you must have and what you would like to have would certainly help you in your decision-making when it comes to buying your first home.
Excellent. Absolutely agree with the must-have, nice-to-haves column. That's what I do when I'm strategizing with any client, but it certainly sharpens the search and it shines a spotlight on whether it's area-related, attributes of the dwelling-related, land size related, and it's really good for people to prioritise which is the thing that they're least willing to compromise on. Now, let's come back to one point I've got here. What can trip up a good strategy? And I've certainly got a long list of things that first home buyers do and first time buyers do that trip up their strategy. But Dave, back to you. What do you often see happening?
Well, look, one thing that comes to mind, and this may not be that often or part of something you were thinking of, but often I see first-time buyers who've ended up purchasing interstate because it's felt affordable to them. Most of our clients are based in Melbourne and Sydney, and so often I've seen they've purchased interstate, and often this can be in a Queensland. They've gone for a lower value property and a higher yield, and then their property hasn't actually kept pace with Melbourne or Sydney property price growth. You know, that's happened many times over the last 15 years. I've seen that. And so then when they're trying to get back into Melbourne or Sydney, they've fallen behind where they'd like to be. So I'm not saying that will happen every time and that necessarily that would happen into the future, but that certainly is a mistake that I've seen first-time buyers make. And so one thing we talk about with each first-time buyer is if they think they have a good idea of where they might want to live long-term, and we've talked about not everyone will have that clarity, and even if they think they do, life can change. But if they do have a sense of that, then you know, look to try and get a foothold in and around that location as early as possible So you're keeping pace with the market where you might end up living in down the track. So that's just one example.
Yeah, that's a really great example, Dave. And my one that I was thinking about were things like white noise and people giving them unsolicited advice and directives coming from everywhere, including, you know, brokers that are flogging things that require a smaller deposit and are giving particular cashbacks or bonuses. That can lead someone down a really bad garden path. But also not being on the same page as other critical decision makers. So if, for example, your parents are helping you out or you've got a guarantor who wants to have a say in what you're doing, you've got to make sure that you're on the same page. If you've got a partner, if you're doing this together, or if you're just cognizant of your partner's needs and requirements, they won't be on board if you're looking at areas that won't work for them. So there are lots of things that trip up good strategy. I often find that it's bad advice or too much unsolicited advice from people that aren't experts.
Yeah, often they're trying to find the silver bullet, looking for the perfect answer, you know, the perfect location, the perfect property,
yeah,
you know, the perfect statistics to back it up. And that can be part of what trips up a first-time buyer. Also, which can trip up a lot of buyers, is just being too broad with your search criteria. Too many suburbs, too many different asset types, you know, bouncing from one part of a city to another part of a city,
yeah,
you know, with different asset types. And they're considering living in it, you know, it's not narrowing in and getting really clear on what you want out of your strategy and if you're going to live in it out of the home.
You raise a really good point. I actually don't like that. And if people do want to focus on different parts of the city, there's got to be a commonality. And they've also got to identify what that is. So, for example, they might be looking for a Californian bungalow with a price point of, you know, 1.2 to 1.5. Well, that might lead them to, in Melbourne-centric terms, it could be a northern location like Preston Coburg and then an inner western location like Newport, Yarraville, maybe West Footscray. So for something like that, I can forgive it because the product makes sense. But yeah, when I've got people asking me to look at a townhouse in South Yarra and then a house in Faulkner and then, oh, what about the peninsula? And can we talk to you about Ballarat? I just think, no, we can't. You're all over the shop. You've got no strategy. Now, Pete, you see this. When you're helping people, particularly first home buyers, circle in on a strategy, how many suburbs do you suggest they focus on and what's your approach to sorting out location?
Okay, so keeping in mind that Adelaide suburbs are quite small with generally thousands of people, whereas in Melbourne and Sydney you can have tens of thousands, I'll say to them, 5 to 6 suburbs. Set yourself an email alert on realestate.com.au, 5 to 6 suburbs, assuming that they're, you know, of a reasonable size, and put in your criteria, you know, your price range, how many bedrooms. If you're not sure what that is, that's okay. Just put in the names of the suburbs. That's the most critical point. And then start going to open inspections. Even though you're not really interested in that particular property, just go and see what your money can buy you so far as where it's located. So it might be in a suburb that you know, but do you like the street and what condition the property is in? Because on realestate.com, I'm sure the photos look fantastic, but you get a much better idea of what it's really like when you physically turn up to the property. So 5 or 6 suburbs and go to those open inspections in the areas you want to live in, even though you might not be particularly interested in buying that specific property.
Great advice. Now, before we move on to G, we'll just finish up with one last point for first-time buyers. And Dave, back to you. What are some of the best ways parents can help first-time buyers?
So probably the best and most common ways that we see through the mortgage arm of our business is putting up one of their properties as security to save the first-time buyer having to pay mortgage insurance, or just giving them a straight cash gift. They're the most common method used by parents.
Absolutely. Now, for parents who aren't in a position to do that or choose not to, there are some really great ways that you can help in terms of moral support and good advice or being someone that they can turn to get steered in the right direction. And I've written a blog about that, so we'll get that in the show notes as well so that parents can have a look at that.
And just one more tip too for our first-time buyers out there. If your parents are helping you or if they're a key confidant for you, ask your advisor, whether it's your mortgage broker, buyer's agent, property planner, if your parents can join you in the meeting. because, you know, we certainly find that often with first-time buyers, it actually helps to have the parents part of the whole process. And we talk to our advisors about asking the first-time buyers if they'd like their parents to join the meeting. For all your first-time buyers out there, ask your trusted advisor. If they're a good advisor, they'll be happy to have your parents or, you know, one of your parents join the meeting. And it just can ensure everyone who's involved in the transaction is on the same page.
Absolutely. Great advice. Now, G is for goal setting. So, Pete, back to you. What's the best way to approach goal setting?
Well, you've got to split up your goals, and I split them up in, are you looking, is your goal to retire richer? Is your goal to retire earlier? Is your goal just to make a little bit of extra money right now? Is your goal to make some regular extra money so maybe you can go and work part-time because you've got extra income coming in from property? Or is your goal to give up your day job? Now, you might have one or more of those goals, but that's going to help determine the sort of property that you buy. So, for example, you can buy yourself a lovely character or period-style home in an inner western suburb, and that's a great strategy if you want to retire richer. But if you want to give up your day job, buying that house and paying it off over 30 years is just not going to do it, unless you plan to give up your day job in 30 years, which is fine. If you want to give up your day job, you either got to renovate on a regular basis or you have to be a developer. If you're going to be a developer, that means you don't want to be buying a really nice house because you're going to be knocking it down. You're paying extra for something you don't need. So when I used to teach the property investment course to the general public, that's the very first session we used to have, which was, what are your goals? Because that'll determine your strategy, which in turn determines the type of property and where you will buy.
Excellent, Pete. Now, what's a common mistake that people make when it comes to goal setting?
They have unrealistic goals, Kate. You know, with all due respect to the older people listening in, and I'm one of the older people, obviously, here. You know, at 55, 60, Pete, I want to retire in 5 years and I don't have any investment property. Oh, well, good luck. How's that going to happen? You know, Dave said it many times. Investing in property is a great way to get rich slowly. So, yeah, unless you're fortunate and you're let's say you invested 2 years ago because the market's gone up, probably over the last 2 years, it's probably gone up close to 40%, then it's just not going to happen. You know, you need to speak to your financial planner and have a look at what your superannuation options are, maybe contributing more to super, because it's certainly more advantageous when you hit 60. And I would encourage any of the, you know, the older people, the more mature people, that's a better word, isn't it? The more mature, experienced people, if you're in your 50s, speak to a financial planner, because super is much more important to you then than it is when you're in your 20s and 30s. So, Kate, to answer your questions in 10 words or less, it's some people have unrealistic goals.
Yes.
And I think even, Pete, when you use the example of, you know, to give up the day job, well, the two examples you gave are creating a new day job.
True. Yeah. Very true. Yeah, it's not money for nothing.
Yes.
It's not dire straits money for nothing, let me tell you.
And it's interesting, when you mention unrealistic goals, I see that come across in a lot of different ways. So sometimes, to your point, Pete, they're not allowing enough time, or they've played it safe or been conservative for most of their working life, and now they're wanting to talk about taking massive risk. Or maybe they don't understand that what they're thinking they could create financially out of property requires a massive risk, and it's not right at that stage in life. The other one that I often see is creating a passive income through being handy and on the tools, and it might be a series of flips or renovating or wanting to do a big development when they've got no experience. And that's dangerous too. So it's interesting to hear you say that, because I often find when it comes to goal setting, they're either not putting any effort into it at all and thinking it's easier than it really is, or their big, hairy, audacious goals are just way too big. They're unreasonable. Now, lastly, how long do you think people should spend on goal setting? And I remember we did a really good episode about this. Personally, I spent 2 weeks. I took time out of work. And you do need to always top up your strategy. But what do you think, Pete?
Well, you probably shouldn't be listening to me, because I never really set any goals. I was more of an opportunist. Dave shouldn't listen to this. I never had a property plan. I was just, you know, when the right property came up at the right time, we bought it. I mean,
but you also sold them.
I did too.
So you did need a plan.
thankfully, we're in a very good position anyway. But, you know, I think, you know, you obviously took it very seriously, Kate. Take 2 weeks off work and work out what your goals are. It might not just be your investment goals, but what are your life goals? You know, that's certainly something that I thought about was not just investment goals, but also life goals. So, you know, what sort of job are you looking for? What's really important in that job? You probably won't have the same job for your whole life, certainly not these days. I mean, in the old days, in my father's day, you probably did, but not these days. So it is really important. And if your job is so busy, you need to take some time out. Now, I know what time out means these days. Time out means that you may not be at the office, but you're still checking your emails. Sometimes my out-of-office email says, I am not within range and I will not be able to answer your emails or phone calls until this date. But if it's urgent, then call this other person or contact this other. That's what you need. Because if you're still, you know, answering calls and answering emails, then you're not really focused on the important things in life. Because the sooner you do it, and you did that fairly early on, did you, Kate?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, the sooner you do it, the better off you're going to be. Rather than, you know, setting a plan at the age of 55, that could be a little bit late. Setting a plan at the age of 25, that's a much better idea.
Yeah, I was 28 when I did that. So I'd already started investing and, and like you, Pete, I had a plan to just be opportunistic and do what I could as quickly as I could. But once I put some context around it and had a plan, it all started to take shape. I do need you as my life coach, though. I love that idea about the email. I don't do that.
I mean, I find it hard to do as well because my ethos is, you know, if I don't check the email today, I've got to check it when I get back to work anyway. But I really love that week between Christmas and New Year because everybody's on holidays. Nobody expects you to reply to emails. You know, that's a great week.
It's a great tip, Pete, to the importance of setting boundaries.
Yeah.
We're inundated with more information and pings and all sorts of things than we ever have been. And it's not something that, you know, I think it's really difficult for the 20-somethings, you know, who are in the workforce and even early 30s because they grew up while we're evolving into that. And, you know, it's not like it was taught to them how to manage it. And we know it's not good for your mental health. You've got to set up ways to minimize how often you're interrupted during a day. Otherwise, you end up just multitasking, doing lots of things poorly and end up can feel overwhelmed and stressed. So, I mean, this isn't a proper tip, is it, Pete? But it's a life tip. But
it's a good life tip, yeah.
It is. It's great. And
take a break. Take a real break.
Very relevant because real estate is one of those industries that doesn't stop and deals get done at night and things heat up after six. And if anyone asks me what my hours look like, you're expected to start at 8:30 in the morning, but you're also expected to be on sometimes until close to midnight if a negotiation is underway. So it's great because a lot of our listeners will be familiar with that. And if they are contemplating purchasing, it's great to put some context around what the summer break looks like. Now, H is for houses, and Pete, you've got in brackets there, not apartments. Do tell.
I don't want to bore our listeners again because I know we've said it, if not 100 times, maybe 200 times. You know, for investment, you should never be buying apartments. And just to define apartments, they're small dwellings in high-rise buildings. Older flats and units are a different product, so far as I'm concerned, because the building has depreciated so much, it's more the land that you're buying rather than the building. But H is for houses. So in my opinion, if you're going to be looking for capital growth, you need to be buying something with some land. Now, I know in Melbourne and Sydney, property is very expensive, so it might be townhouses because the beauty about townhouses, they do have a reasonable land component. May not be huge, but it's certainly better than apartments.
Great, Pete. Now, what denotes houses versus units? Let's talk about...
Oh, very, very good question, mate. You know, is a penthouse a house or a house or unit? Probably a unit. Is a townhouse a house or a unit? Probably a unit.
Yep.
But ABS defines it differently to CoreLogic, which probably defines it differently to SQM Research, who probably define it differently to others.
I
have spoken
to
Tim Lawless of CoreLogic, and their main criteria is if the property has common property, like a common driveway It's on community title. It's on strata title. That generally they'll call that a unit. But I have seen many detached houses on community title. So community title is something we have in Australia, which is, say, a hybrid between strata title and Torrens title, because it's easier, it's cheaper, sorry, to have it on community title than Torrens title, because community title, you can share a sewerage line, which will save about $10,000 in your subdivision costs.
Yeah.
But, yeah, look, it's very hard to define, depends on who you speak to. But whenever I do my research, I generally speak about median house prices rather than median property prices, because generally houses are better defined than units.
Great answer. I've opened Pandora's box there. We'll have to come back to that, because I think understanding strata and the impact that it has on how property is denied is really important.
Good one. That's another whole episode.
It is.
Yes.
And it's very hard when agents are reporting data as well, because they can categorize something also. We know that. Mm. And sales information that gets recorded, sometimes it's very difficult to wade through that, because the accuracy of the data is reliant on how correct and authentic it is.
I looked at a set of plans yesterday that somebody's looking to develop, right? And they have called them detached terrace houses, right? Now, when you speak to somebody and you say the word detached, they think they're separate, but they're not, because the walls are abutting.
Mm.
And there is a difference between abutting and adjoining.
There is.
We talked about trying to define houses and units. We'll try and define detached. Does detached really mean separate?
Therein lies another episode.
Another episode.
In our property reviews, we use ABS stats to spell out how many standalone houses are in the suburb, how many semi-detached.
That's
and
a
how
good
many
definition,
units.
Standalone, because standalone means standalone.
Yeah. Yes. So standalone, semis, and then units, and then what the change has been over the last 5 years, because you can get a sense of what's being built, what's being subdivided. But we also do have the definitions in there of the ABS definitions and the CoreLogic definitions and how they differ, because how the agent's selling it, they might be calling it a different name to what the ABS had called it to, or what CoreLogic had called it. So it can be confusing. I mean, we had one we reviewed this week, which is a villa unit. The agents were calling it in reservoir, but it was probably considered as a semi-detached in ABS stats. But you sort of had to have a discussion. Was it a unit? Was it semi-detached? You know, was it a standalone? It can be confusing.
It is indeed. Now, there's one little point I want to make before we roll on to the letter I. I feel like I'm doing Sesame Street or something. Today's magic letter.
The alphabet of property.
Yeah. I've got a question here that I'm going to answer, if that's okay. A common misconception about houses being a superior asset than units. You can never have a blanket statement like that, because it depends on where it is, how big it is, what it is. And a lot of people have this determination to buy a house on its own block of land at any cost, because they think that that's the best way to do it. And we've talked in previous podcast episodes about bigger not always being better. And I also want to add that a house is not always better as an option than a unit. I've seen plenty of houses that I would prefer to steer clear of and go for a great unit for a similar price. So you've really got to think about what your goals are, where the unit is, what sort of rental return it could deliver, what sort of maintenance updates it requires, whether units in that particular suburb are revered by tenants, and whether homeowners can get mileage out of it and have something that's future-proofed. So I think it's really important not to just assume that houses always outperform units, because there's plenty of examples where they don't.
Yeah.
You're both nodding. True. This is great.
Well, in particular location, yeah. You know, to get a poorly located house, you're much better off to get a better located townhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a few statistics on this too, just in terms of property values, how they've changed since 2007 in the capital cities. And look, but most of the capital cities were around the difference in the median between houses and units in 2007 was around 20 to 25, maybe 30%. Now the difference is over 50% in most capital cities, and as high as 70% in some. And there's different reasons for that. Hobart's the only one that's sort of still similar. There's only been a smaller gap between the two. But pretty much, you know, if you bought a unit on average and a house on average, and obviously it's not horses for courses, that were at the same price point in 2007, you would have outperformed significantly with the house.
For those listeners that want to do their own research, if you just Google ABS, maybe Established House Price Index, if you're only focused on houses, look at the Established House Price Index. If you're only focused on units, have a look at the Attached Dwellings Price Index. If you want to combine the both, have a look at the Residential Property Price Index. So three different indices there to look at.
And just to reinforce why the supply-demand factor often is a big part of this equation, so Canberra in particular has had the biggest gap. So it was around 30% difference in median in 2007. It's 74.8%, so the highest of the cities. Well, in the last 10 years in Canberra, there's been 841 houses built, but 4,593 units.
Wowzers. Okay, on that note, we're catching the express train straight to the IJK stations because we've got 10 minutes left.
Well, I was thinking we've still got to go through to Zed. I assume Pete's got through. Have you got through to Zed, Pete?
That'll be other series. So I think what we'll do later on when we finish, we'll put them all together and we'll call it the alphabet of property. So next time it'll be LMNOP, so the L to P of property. Today is the F to K of property.
I love it. Okay, eyes for interest rates. Dave, straight over to you.
I don't know whether it's the most important thing or not in Pete's mind, but I think it's the simplest thing to understand. We all know that 2.9 is lower than 2.91. So people can get sucked into focusing in on interest rates when it's the easiest part to understand, okay? And the thing we know is it doesn't matter how much you search, there's always going to be a lower interest rate somewhere. You know, there's going to be a lower interest rate in 1 month, 1 year. So really you've got to just decide first and foremost, what's your mortgage strategy, okay? And that's where people often, and a lot of the mortgage industry doesn't focus in on, and that, you know, can make hundreds of thousands of difference to your bottom line come retirement. Your mortgage strategy can have a profound impact on your cash flow, your financial, property and investment opportunities. If managed well, it can allow acquisition of assets, superior money management, and a stable financial situation. But if you pay scant attention and you get it wrong, the cost of selling assets, lost tax deductions, an inability to accumulate assets, poor money management, increased interest costs and stress levels can be astronomical. So I say, as you know, our regular listeners would know, get your mortgage strategy right. Speak to a really good strategic mortgage broker, then find the lender with a great interest rate that can provide you, meet your mortgage strategy. And really, you know, if you want a low interest rate, just decide how often do you want to refinance, okay? Because there's always going to be a lower interest rate around and you don't want to tie yourself up in knots because you see another low interest rate a week later or 3 months later or 6 months later.
Yeah, very true. I remember talking to a mortgage broker years ago and they were talking about how they get clients and, you know, how they continue working with people. And if it's only about rate, that's a real churn model. And I remember someone saying, if I win them on rate, I'll lose them on rate.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think battle in price, you know, not many winners there.
Yeah, there's
it's a race to the bottom. Yeah.
So much more to working with a great broker than just getting the sharpest interest rate. Because aside from the attributes of the loan product and the things that you can do, the flexibility that you can do, it's also about having a great strategy and someone who understands it. And I can't say that loud enough.
Let's not forget the eighth modern wonder of the world, the offset account.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to shut down that conversation because that's another 10 hours, isn't it, Dave?
It is. That's another episode. My God.
Now, the next point, I love this point. J is for just do it. And I remember years ago I went to this seminar and it was a motivational seminar and it had this personality up on stage. And she walked up and had chalk in her hand and wrote on this board, JFDI. Kind of scratching her heads for just a moment. And I was like, right, I know exactly what she's saying.
There's no F here.
You can't.
Yeah. You've got to do
we might
it.
Have to beep.
This is a PG show. Again,
a bit like the earthquake.
No, no, I didn't say it, but it was very effective because a lot of people don't just do it and need to. So this is all about analysis paralysis and people putting things off, and it's a great point. So, Dave, I'll hand over to you and let you talk about just do it.
Paralysis by analysis. People, again, I guess a bit like chasing the lowest interest rate or looking at too many different suburbs, they'll end up not making a decision. And really, I think it's quite difficult. We assess everyone's risk profile as part of the property plan, and some people just are more conservative. And so often it is the more conservative people with the more conservative nature. Ultimately, we find what we're searching for. And if we're searching for reasons not to do something and we want to reinforce why it's a big risk, we'll find reasons often why it's a big risk. And so I think it starts with understanding yourself. And if you are more conservative, you're more prone to probably not take action and paralysis by analysis. So, and if you're probably a number, too deep of a number cruncher, and often that can be, and you do understand the approaches different professions take to financial advice, don't you, Kate? I think we're talking about it over Saturday night. Often engineers will overanalyze and not make decisions, for example. And sometimes you can find maybe maths, people with a maths background or a maths teacher. If you don't take action, you're going to cost yourself money. And inaction over a lifetime might mean you started 5 years later and like $1 million at 5%. Over 25 years versus over 30 years is a $1 million difference at retirement. So, the power of compounding is one of the key reasons why you just have to take action.
Absolutely. And I've got one point here. How can buyers overcome this? And the advice that I give anyone, particularly the really analytical types that are looking for data to give them a compelling answer, is to don't do that. You won't get your data giving you that answer. And the reason for that is there's so much more to property than just past performance and projected returns and all of the other things that we look at, the metrics. There's more to property than just metrics. And the problem with weighting a property and giving it a scorecard is so much of it's subjective. It depends on who you are, what you are, what your tenant is looking for, or what sort of needs you have if you're trying to analyze your own home purchase, which is another layer of difficulty. And we often see analytical types doing that. You've actually got to put a weighting on things that make you happy and things that deliver less stress. And it's really hard to put that weighting down on paper because your life stage might determine that maintenance call-outs when you're a tradie and you're in your 20s is no bother. But when you're interstate and you're in your 60s, it's a massive bother. So these are the reasons why someone who is struggling to just do it with an analytical approach, these are the reasons why it does feel difficult for them. It's because they're looking for something that's a high scorer and they're looking for the data to give them a compelling decision. They've actually got to be prepared to take a commercial risk and consider their shades of grey and tap into how they feel about the situation as well.
100%. I mean, there's years of experience that you can't put a measure around. How much have you read? How much have you learned? How much have you analysed? That goes to your intuition, and every market-based decision, every individual in a market is making some decisions based off that. There isn't perfect mathematical equations that say, this property is going to be the best performer in this city for the next 10 or 20 years. You're also basing some of the decision on what may happen in the future. And obviously no one has a crystal ball. So there isn't a perfect mathematical equation or, pull out the data to equal a perfect equation to pick the perfect property.
So true. Now, we've got our last letter. K is for knowledge. And we are running short, but we designed it this way to have each of us share one key tip, and that can be our gold nuggets. So, Pete, K is for knowledge.
That's very clever, Kate. Running out of time, let's use it as a gold nugget. I love it. Let's do that.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
So what's your gold nugget, Pete?
Mine is pay for it. And it took me a long time before I came to putting my hands in my pocket and paying for advice. But I admitted to myself, you know, we only just recently got a financial planner. You know, she'll be right. I know what I'm doing. You know, honestly, when anyone talked to me about superannuation, my eyes just glazed over. I just didn't get it. So, you know, I hunted around for a good financial planner, but also could explain things in simple terms. I mean, I don't think I'm a simple person, but when it comes to super, because there's so many, you know, different rules and they change all the time. So, you know, I sleep much better at night knowing that I am definitely on the right path. So happy to pay for it. Yeah, you can listen to podcasts and you can read articles and magazines. Yeah, that's all lovely. But in the end, if you're going to get serious, you're going to pay for it.
Interesting. I'm going to pop in a really little gold nugget of mine because I'm technically not meant to have one. I'm hosting.
<Go for it.
laughs> Talk to someone who's done it.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got more than one person, that's even better. But speak to someone who has done it. Don't establish ideas about where you want to take your property strategy if you haven't talked to someone who actually has got an investment portfolio themselves. Dave, over to you.
I'll just build on Pete. So pay for it, but select well. So select the right trusted advisors, pay for it, and with a strategic mortgage broker, understand there's a value for their service. And even though in Australia and many countries you don't have to pay to get a mortgage, you are paying for it. So you should put a value on that service. You pay for it through obviously the interest rate and any fees. And then obviously the providers, whether it's the banks and the mortgage brokers, they get a payment. So there is a fee, it's just hidden up in the product. I agree with both yours, but yeah, pay for it, but be wise in your selection of who you use.
Yeah, trusted, qualified people, well, definitely.
Guys, it's been great. We've gone well over time. Jamie, our audio man, is probably going to tell us off for this one. I haven't been a very good gatekeeper here with the time, but I hope our listeners have really enjoyed today's F to K of property. We'll see you next week.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about some of the themes discussed, take a listen to episode number 9, Why Your Mortgage Strategy is More Important Than Your Interest Rate. Episode number 16, Unpacking Land to Asset Ratio. Episode number 60, Why Established Properties Outperform. Episode 82, Goal Setting Fundamentals for Property Success. Episode 95, Security Guarantees, Co-Borrowing, Gifts and More, Helping Your Kids Buy Their First Property. And finally, episode 125, Does Size Matter? Should you buy a small block of land in a great location or a bigger block further out?
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.